do look great, though.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah, he said he said that to my wife. He says, doesn't he look great? He says, I can't believe he's looked at my, he says, you're going to be 59? You look great, man. He says, I honestly didn't think you'd be coming back for that.
Yeah.
I thought he was really surprised.
Yeah, that's incredible. Lavance Jeffries, LJ Consulting Group, LJ Security Consulting.
That's it.
It's been a while. Last time when we were babies, we're LA County Sheriff. What year was that?
That's
88, 89? When we met?
88. No. Yeah, 88. No. Yeah, 89, I believe. 89. I think I got to Biscayne Center in 89.
Yeah, that's where we met, right?
Yeah.
You believe it? Now we're sitting here today.
Yeah.
Retired? Are you kidding?
Talk about time flying. 30. I don't even want to do the math, but yeah, 30. I know at least 37 years ago.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah, we're both head full of black, stone black hair.
Yeah.
No gray.
No gray. That's right.
Standing amazing. Up straight.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a great journey, though. The career was, I was so excited, and it was everything I thought it'd be and more.
Yeah, yeah, I never thought I was going to leave that.
Yeah. Yeah, you were good at it. You were natural.
I never thought I was going to leave that.
Yeah. Yeah, I was surprised you left.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that were mad.
Yeah. I see that.
Yeah. Just timing. It's just weird how things happen.
It is. It is.
And then I feel bad because I got into the security business and then I called you.
Yeah.
And I got you and your partner started in the business. You got to share that story real quick and then we'll go back. What I like to do too is want to go back, if you don't mind. I say this on all the podcasts. People like to know a little bit about you, family, if that's okay, real quick, because we got a lot to talk about. We've got LJ Security Consulting. You've done executive protection. You do training for some schools.
Right.
A lot of things that you're doing right now, but let's go back.
Right. Yeah, it's so funny that period of time in my life, I don't even know how I pulled that off. The 24/7 job with LA County Sheriff, and then where I found the time to help out with the security company on your side, you and Russ. And I think I ran into Russ at the police credit union. I thought it was you, and I'm having this conversation with him. And he's like, finally, he tells me, look, dude, I think you want to talk to my brother.
For the record, a lot of people may not know, but I have a twin brother. In fact, identical twin.
Yes.
Now, the funny part about us is that we're called mirror twins. You ever hear that?
Yes.
Okay, so I'm right-handed, he's left-handed. My hair, colic in the back, goes to the right, his goes to the left. So it's like looking at a mirror. Yeah.
I didn't know you had an identical twin, but I honestly did not believe him. I'm thinking, okay, this is Chris just playing games. And I follow him to the dispatch center right there in Bellflower. And then you guys are standing next to each other, and I'm just like, and all the time I had known you, I guess that had never come up. So I didn't know you had an identical twin.
Yeah.
Yeah, so funny. But he brought me over, showed me the operation. At that time, that was a 24-hour dispatch for all of the L.A. area. I think San Diego.
Correct.
Had a couple of counts of San Diego at the time. And, yeah, the whole operation, it was in full swing and expanding, and we had a good time. We had a lot of fun.
Yeah, we were doing parking, security, the whole bit. I got to tell you a funny story about the twin thing since we're on it. I was at a grocery store, and I see this guy way at the other end, and he's giving me this weird look, and he has an empty shopping cart. So he looks at me, gets this look, and he starts charging me with his cart. Okay? I have no idea who this guy is, but he starts running like full speed. And just as he comes up to me, pulls the cart back and slams it back down. And I'm thinking to myself, well, we're cops, right? I'm thinking, I don't even know who this guy is. Same thing.
Yeah.
He didn't even believe me. I had to take my ID out to show him. and it was actually Russ's golf instructor.
Wow.
He had no idea. Russ and I are such great communicators. Yeah. So I didn't mean to get off on a tangent, but
yeah,
the security itself was, San Diego. Mm-hmm. We were doing parking, security, we were doing maintenance, taking the calls and all that. But I don't know if I was selling Amway and convinced you to come in. I forgot how that went.
Yeah, you just showed me the operation, and I was active with the sheriffs at the time, so I was... You stole a lot of tricks of the trade from the sheriff's department, right? And so I was familiar with everything, how we wrote citations and everything. And yeah, it was incredible. So I definitely wanted to get involved. So I got involved, and I don't know how. I think back now, I think I was living in Lakewood in a new house that I had just bought. And I was getting up at 2 a.m. sometimes to go take a boot off. And my wife is looking at me like, what is wrong with you? Have you lost your mind? Yeah. But man, talk about fun. And then of course, doing my 10-hour, sometimes 16-hour shifts with the sheriff's department, and then go home, change out. And now I'm out there rolling in my little Toyota truck with some, what do you call them? What we put on the wheels?
Boots.
Boots. Boots in the back. Yeah.
Yeah, just for the record, for those of you watching, the boot, we call it the boot, is an immobilization device that we used to clamp on the vehicles versus towing them. We had it set up as it was a contract, individual contract with each resident at the community. So versus having them be towed, it was an agreement, kind of like a garage keeper's lien. We had to post the signs and at the entries and exits. Was on private property. It had nothing to do with the municipality side, but an agreement. And then if anybody fell, I think it was a second or third violation, a clamp went on their vehicle. But it was way different back then because the tires were different. We didn't have all those fancy rims they have today.
Right.
And it was the same ones that they called it the Denver boot originally because that's where it originated, out of Denver. So they called it the Denver boot.
Okay.
We were using those orange boots.
Orange ones, yeah.
Yeah, and those were called the Rhino. That was out of Mighty Manufacturing. Then I was a national distributor for them.
Okay. Okay.
I think you remember as I was actually consulting with the cities at the time. Yeah. And I was selling them the devices and teaching them how to do that.
It was amazing in that we could totally control the parking.
Yeah.
We could lock a car down and... I think visitor parking was out of control and people were just parking in where they want it. So it's pretty substantial when you're talking about a 100-unit building and all the parking that goes with that.
Yeah.
200-unit buildings. I think in San Diego we had a couple of 200-unit buildings, 150 units. You figure 2 parking spaces per unit. It's a lot of parking to control.
Yeah.
And a lot of college kids.
You remember.
And, yeah. Yeah, but it was, and I think we were definitely ahead of our time because I remember going out on some sales calls with you, and a lot of security companies at that time were keeping all of their records out of a red book at the front desk. And that's parking issues, maintenance issues, everything went in that red book. So to come in there with a early version of a database and be able to keep track of that. I remember going into a room with one of the managers and a room this size with just these red books piled up to the ceiling for all the years that they had been keeping their records. That's how they would have to go and index and find stuff. And we came in with we had the device that we could actually scan the parking permits and it's all on database. We could figure the managers, I believe, or we would enter in all the information. So we scan the car and we know what unit you live in, how many cars you're allowed, what kind of car. Yeah, we were definitely ahead of our time.
You actually remember that?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I remember it got to the point where because of how antiquated these security companies' managers were, the apartment buildings, it got to the point where we did sales calls where we just would show where we were on the technology side, and literally no one would say no to us. It got to the point where we had to slow down because every account we went for, we got it.
Yeah,
they look at their red book and then they look at our device. It was a no-brainer.
Yeah, because it's a 24-hour operation, multiple residents, especially college kids, because they're living three or four deep, eating 50 pounds of raw hamburger meat and playing Duke Nukem all night. And yeah, it was the number one and two issue at residential communities, at least here in California, primarily Orange County, LA, San Diego, where the communities could never get to a 95.5, the vacancy factor. They get it full, of course, quickly, but then the problem was parking.
Yeah.
Not enough spaces, and then trying to control future prospective parking and all those things. And towing, the bad part about towing at the time, the towing had no restrictions. If you remember correctly, they could come in and try to sell that program, paint the fire lanes, put the signs up, do the striping for you, and they say, we'll handle it. And then anybody that didn't have a permit, they would tow.
Yeah.
And that was a nightmare because these kids can't afford that. But the fact that we came in and we educated, tried to change behavior, create a better environment using tools that we had, that was a big deal for them.
Oh, yeah.
And, of course, it led to security contracts.
Absolutely.
But the only problem is people, right? I think it's just employees, right? It's just the industry itself. And I know we always talk about that, but I think I remember you coming and going, hey, what's the deal here? You didn't tell me this part.
Yeah. Well, that's always a nightmare, managing people and managing their expectations, the manager's expectations. Of course, you go in there and sell your people and say you have the best people and they're responsible and we're doing everything by the book. But executing that is not always as easy as it sounds when you're dealing with people, because people have issues and then personal issues that they bring to work. And managing that was more challenging than the actual work. The actual work, just managing, getting people to come to work on time and keeping their personal lives separate from their professional lives. Because I think that was our big thing, because we were both from the Sheriff's Department. We wanted to exhibit or model professionalism. And for security companies, they get a bad rap. Oftentimes, they don't get a lot of respect because they lack professionalism. And just today, I look at it, just walking into a grocery store and seeing a guard leaning against the wall, looking at their phone, watching Netflix, or on the phone with his girlfriend or her boyfriend, or sitting in the car in the parking lot with their boots off, with their feet up on the dash. How do you manage that? And how do you convey to these young people just starting out their careers, many of them in their early 20s, that you want people to look at you as professional? You know, that's just, it's a tough sell at that age.
Yeah, it is. You know, it's changed a lot too, don't you think? Think the people have changed, or is that just my age? It seems like it's, maybe it's the devices now.
Yeah.
Or,
yeah, it's.
Because we tried to hire a lot of the explorers, remember, from the department.
Absolutely.
So we had kids that were wanting to be law enforcement. They looked up to us. And then, of course, security could give them a bad name if they weren't doing a good job. Because I think his background investigation, did you do backgrounds for a while?
I did.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
What's your thought on that? Not to change subject, as far as backgrounds mean. I think people should know. Security is not only when you say, oh, I want to go with security so I can do law enforcement. I don't think necessarily that's a great idea at all times.
Yeah, I don't either. And in fact, I did backgrounds for sworn as well as the civilian side. For Sheriff's Department has a position called custody assistant. And those are men and women that primarily work in the jails. And these are LETs that are technicians that work in the station. They usually man your 911 phone calls coming in, dispatch. So I was hiring for those positions and interviewing young people. And you're right. You're absolutely right. Back then, devices were not as prevalent. Cell phones were bigger and more rare for you to have a cell phone because it was expensive. But now, everybody's got a cell phone. Homeless people have cell phones.
Yeah.
Everyone's got a cell phone. And so the distractions and all of the things that cause you to be not focused on whatever your function is are definitely a factor. But I did backgrounds probably in the 90s, and people coming in, a lot of people don't realize that law enforcement agencies And of course, security companies hire people. They're just regular people. They're just, they're no different than you. They're regular people. They have problems. They have jobs and marriages and kids and the same problems that everyone else has. And oftentimes, I think law enforcement is viewed as being these special, or as maybe they're held up to that standard of being someone that's supposed to be always professional, always in control of your emotions, always these impossible standards, but they're just regular people. But I believe no matter if it's law enforcement or the military, I think it just takes a special dedication, especially when you're young, to dedicate yourself to being super professional at whatever you're doing. I don't care if you're a street sweeper, you're just professional at whatever you do. So that's what we were trying to convey back then to a lot of young people. And we had a lot of successes. We had our challenges with some people, but we had a lot of successes, and we turned a lot of people around, a lot of young people around, and made them more aware. And that was the rewarding part of being involved with kids at a young age in their early 20s and knowing that they got so much life ahead of them and just preparing them for that. So what they would face.
You know how many kids I hired now that are lieutenants and captains?
Yeah, absolutely.
Working LAPD, LA County Sheriff, yeah. It's amazing.
Same here. I run into people all the time. I don't always remember their faces because they've changed, but they tell me I look exactly the same. But they tell me, hey, you did my background, or I worked just security with you, or I met you during the process. Or sometimes I see security guards that look like, to me, they have just so much potential, and they're wasting it with that particular security company. So I either will approach them. Back then I used to approach them with a card and say, hey, if you're putting yourself at risk out here in this dangerous area, you might as well be getting paid what you're worth or what you deserve, but you should be getting paid more than what you're getting paid now. So have you ever considered a career in law enforcement or being working for a municipality? And a lot of times, and those are the kids I'm running into today, that they got their start and they were just working at security companies or a dime a dozen, and you can get fired on a Monday and have another job on Wednesday.
Isn't that the truth?
And that new company that hires you won't even take the time to look at your why you were fired from the last company. So yeah, I feel good about that, running into people today that saw me early on and got the start, and Sheriff's Department as well.
Yeah.
A lot of kids.
A lot of guys are going to ask her, I think, on backgrounds, because you did work background. I want to go there just for a minute, if you don't mind. So on backgrounds, tell them what the department's looking for, or you as a background investigator. What is your concern? What are some of the things they really need to stay with? And I know it's been a while. It's different.
Yeah.
Back then, it's going to be hard to get people even to apply after today.
Yeah.
The way the world is today.
Yeah.
It's a very tough job. I'd like to, I think we had a lot of fun.
Yeah.
It was a way different world. But if you don't mind, just for those that are interested in thinking, hey, I'd love to go, I'd like to apply for the police department. What could they do to better themselves to maybe have a better chance?
Sure. The optimal time to enter law enforcement, that really doesn't exist. It's always been a tough job. In the 80s, in the 70s, and certainly in the 90s, is always a tough career to enter into. But what we looked for, I would always refer to them as special individuals that wanted to do something for their community. And to be out there risking your life and doing something for perfect strangers takes a special kind of person. So you look for that quality. Someone that wants to serve, and understanding the ramifications of that word, serve, service, being a public servant is exactly what it is. We obviously look for that characteristic. We look for someone that we know you're young, but it basically have your priorities straight in terms of your credit. You shouldn't have a whole lot of credit at that time established, but maybe not bad credit, not irresponsibility
where you go out and buy something and then you, that you can't afford and mess your credit up. So credit is part of it, looking into your credit, your background, looking into your driving history. Obviously, if you've had any felony arrest or and even the misdemeanor arrest, looking into that and how that happened, how you got involved in that. Sometimes those are bad choices, hanging around the wrong people, choosing the wrong friends. So we looked at that. And we all believe that when we came on or during our era, things were different. And they were to an extent, but people are people. And we had distractions back then, but nothing close to how kids have to navigate through this world today. Thank God that I wasn't born or young during this period of time, because the distractions and the social media and the pressure of that is just nothing like we experienced. It's tough. It's tough. And so we definitely look at, basically we want someone to mold, look at your ability to make decisions under pressure. And this is just the application process. All that is delved into even deeper if you're lucky enough to make it to the academy, because 1% of people that apply to law enforcement in general, 1% make it through the entire process. And that's, it's tough to hire. This is why most departments run at a deficit. I believe the sheriff's department, as long as I can remember, have always been anywhere from 1,000 to 1,500 people below their quota, or what, not quota, but their hiring level. They've always been the trying to catch that number, catch up. And then you got people retiring. You hire 100. And then I think just recently, I retired in 2020. That month that I retired, which was March of 2020, 400 people retired that one day. You're chasing your tail. You're just never going to catch up, which makes it really tough. And some departments choose to lower the standards just to catch up. And that's that can come back and bite you.
I think it has, don't you?
Absolutely. I think it has. I think it's always been a tough job. And hiring young people that can handle that kind of responsibility at that age has always been tough. But I think it's even tougher now.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
When we were applying, so much as touched marijuana, unless you're in the military, the Vietnam era, is like, you're done.
Yeah.
A couple speeding tickets, you're done.
Yeah.
Today, like you said, social media, all the things that our kids have available to them to get in trouble, make poor decisions emotionally, and to go through it, because you got your application process, you got your backgrounds, you got your psych, you got your medical, all that stuff, till you even get to phase two, right?
Yeah.
So
one of the standard questions today is, how many times have you smoked marijuana? Not if you've smoked marijuana. My background investigator, when I was going through the process, I was just out of the military, fresh out of the military. And this lady that was my background investigator, she would not believe that I'd never smoked marijuana. She just didn't buy it. And I told her, I'm telling you the truth. I don't know what else you want me to tell you, that I've smoked marijuana, even though I haven't. She just didn't believe it. And but now there's, if you've only smoked 20 times in the past year and all these other considerations, they've had to adjust because it's so common now. And just the environment has these kids thinking that is a way to deal with issues in anxiety and mental health and all these different things. It's really pushed more as being an alternative. To find a high school kid now that hasn't at least experimented is very rare.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Plus, it's legal.
Yeah, it's legal. They're vaping, and you can vape tobacco. You can vape marijuana. It's very common to see a kid 15, 16 smoking, vaping.
Yeah.
And not to say that's a reason they shouldn't have a shot at a job, at a career. But it does definitely does make it tougher, too, because that speaks to who you choose to hang around with and who you choose as friends. And sometimes that's what is their downfall, making decisions about who your friends are going to be.
Yeah.
And if I want to know anything about you, all I have to do is look at your friends. And that tells me a lot about you.
Yeah. Yeah, they walk the neighborhood and background to my end.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. Yeah. Me too.
And I was thinking, man, I hope to... But I didn't do anything too bad as a kid. They hang me out.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting dichotomy from now and then. I would imagine being a background investigator now is pretty tough. Yeah, pretty tough. To get some viable candidates, it's pretty tough.
I don't know. Scares the heck out of me, man.
And then you give this, I think you have to be, I think when I came on, you had to be 20 and a half.
Yes.
20 and a half.
And graduated by, 21 to carry the gun, right?
Mm-hmm. And you're giving these people, these young people, a badge, a gun, and some authority at that young age. And some, we all know some kids that are even 17, 18 that are very mature for their age. And then you have the opposite of that, too. You have people that are 30, 40 years old that are not mature at all,
yeah,
and still at that time involved in gangs, and they're 40 years old.
Yeah.
So it's very tough to find good candidates. And a lot of law enforcement agencies are scavenging the earth, going to different states, trying to find candidates. And it is tough. It's really tough. And
yeah, because kids today are changed drastically because of social media. They don't communicate. Everything's on the tool. That's a big skill set with the department.
Absolutely.
I don't know about you. When I was on the street, that was a huge deal, be able to communicate.
Absolutely.
That was the number one thing.
Absolutely.
The first stage, right?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I tell people now when I teach these classes, I tell them that my biggest asset as a law enforcement officer was my communication skills. If you communicate well, you can get people to do what you want them to do without having to put your hands on them. That helps you tremendously. And even though you're competent in all that stuff that you're carrying on your belt, your taser, your pepper spray, your baton, and of course your last resort, your firearm, no one should be wanting to go out there and have to use any of that stuff if you can communicate effectively. And then you just your presence. Some people just will look you up and down and develop an opinion of you in a matter of seconds. And you want them to look at you and think, this person is squared away. This person knows how to use that radio. They know how to get someone here fast, which is, means I may get caught. And especially in the security field, that's your job, is to be a deterrent. And if you look like you know what you're doing, just look like you know what you're doing, you're effective. So very important.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, retired, you did some executive protection as well. In fact, you've done a lot of executive protection that I want to get into, not only just the consulting side, but to get into that training. But how'd you get into the executive protection?
Total fluke. Just working with people over the years, some law enforcement, some security professionals, just working with them over the years and leaving a good impression, making contacts. And then one of my biggest clients just came from a phone call with someone that heard about me, someone that I knew that had given this person my name. And he says, I can't go into the particular client, but they basically told me that we have a billionaire client and he comes to the Los Angeles area once or twice a year with his family, and we need someone basically to protect him, protect his family, that type of thing. And I'm just like, wow, okay. And they told me you came highly recommended, and I had over the years with the department and outside of the department done some executive protection, but yeah, that kind of threw me into that world. And yeah, it was a very great experience for me. I had some good and bad, but for the most part, really good experience with businessmen in particular, which I prefer over celebrities. I had some work with some celebrities who I won't name, but the difference is the celebrities oftentimes wanted to be seen, and the businessmen like traveling in anonymity. And I've had a burger with one of my clients, and we're standing in front of a burger stand in Santa Monica, and this guy is worth $10 billion, and nobody knows. And he wears jeans and a T-shirt and a G-Shock watch, and the guy's worth $10 billion.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. And he loves it. He loves the fact that he could come out here to the United States and nobody knows who he is, because in his country, everyone knows where he is, who he is. So he can't do that. And he has a full security staff and the whole thing in his country. But when he's out here, he lives free. The only way you'd know this guy has money is because of some of the vehicles he drives. But just down to earth, very nice people that I work with. They travel with nannies, and they're just, they never one day I work for them told me anything to do. Always ask politely. Their kids are well-behaved, traveled, speak 3 or 4 different languages. And yeah, it was totally eye-opener for me, and I really enjoyed that versus being with some high-end celebrity that wants to be seen, that wants the paparazzi chasing us, that wants me telling me to run the light when I'm driving them to the airport or whatever, run the light. Just a total different sides of the spectrum.
What's it, if you can or can you, on the executive side, what are the what's primary duties? Let's go back to the business guy. What did you find yourself doing? Because I wanted to have the listeners understand a little bit about it. Because a lot of them think you just sit outside in the car, but there was a lot more to it.
Yeah, with this particular client, several little clients I've had, you basically become part of the family. And they're just doing regular things, going to the grocery store, going to dinner. And sometimes if they're out here on vacation, they're traveling with their regular, like, 4 or 5 family members, and then they'll have friends that come into town. So now you may have 10 people. So you're me and my partner, we have both in SUVs and just coordinating where we're gonna be going and going there ahead of time and scoping it out and just making sure that we're keeping our clients safe. But basically that's what you're doing. They're very adamant that they don't want you to look like security. You're traveling with the family. It's very low key, and you just blend in and make sure they get in and out of the whatever it is, restaurant, airport, movie theater, because they like to do all that stuff. They like to go to amusement parks, and we're right there with them. And primarily just keeping an eye on their biggest concern are their kids' safety, the wife, and that kind of thing. But very good work in terms of developing a relationship with the client, doing a lot of communication on the front end to find out what they'd like, what they don't like. A lot of times they don't like you being overprotective. They just want you to be there when something happens. And in fact, I found out with this one particular client, the reason that they switched and ended up with me is because they had an incident where a homeless person approached the wife and put hands on her and got too close. And they felt like the security, their executive protection should have saw that coming and should have been more prepared. And so those are the type of things. They just want to be able to go anywhere anybody can go and not have to worry about security issues, safety issues. And then they also always have in the back of their mind that somebody from their country may also be on vacation and recognize them. So that's a concern too. Because like I said, they can travel in anonymity here. Nobody knows who they are. But if someone from their country knows that guy's worth $10 billion,
yep,
that's another concern. And then, of course, going to the high-end stores and shopping and having hundreds of thousands of products that they purchased, bags of stuff in their hands. I would go with the wife, and she's buying a purse that's worth $30,000, a little purse. And you can't just leave the store and walk down the street and get to your car in L.A. without taking some precautions for that. So that's basically what the job entailed, just trying to always stay 10 steps ahead of whatever they're doing.
That $30,000 purse. What do you do at the restaurants? Do you, when you say blend in, do you just grab another table in the corner typically?
Typically, me and my partner would sit at the bar.
And we have a visual on them, and they're at a huge table, but we can see them. And and then just being, knowing the routine of they're going to be there for a while, and we grab something to eat as well, and then going from there, getting them all into the cars, and then back home without any issues. Just blending in.
They liked us to go, when we go to amusement parks with 9 people, they want us to go on the rides with them and that kind of thing. It's not a bad gig.
Wow.
Not a bad gig. And you're getting paid pretty good money. So a lot of fun.
Yeah. Wow. That is sound like a lot.
Versus a client that very well-known person. I won't say his name. It's hard for me not to, though, because this guy gave me a fit. And he doesn't want to listen to you, doesn't believe he needs security. He wants fans coming right up to him and just puts you in all these compromising positions and then doesn't want to listen to you, doesn't consider what you're suggesting is necessarily how he wants to do it. He doesn't want you to touch him, you know, or guide him, get in between you, him and a fan is a whole different.
It's almost like, mindset. Why have me, huh?
Why have me? But then you're the first one that gets blamed if something happens to him. So yeah, just if I had my preference, give me a businessman that nobody knows, and I'll do that before any celebrity. Now, I have worked for a couple of celebrities that were just top notch. And the first day, they sit down and talk to you and let you know what they expect. And you let them know how you work, and you find a happy medium, and just great experience. So I've worked with some really professional celebrities as well.
Can we name one? Or no? Probably can or can't.
I worked with Queen Latifah.
Really?
Yeah. And this lady is just a true professional. Made me feel welcome and made me feel comfortable. And I'm there to try to make her feel comfortable, but she's the one making me relax and feel comfortable with being with her. She shot a commercial a couple times out here in LA, and I had a friend that worked for her, and he wasn't available, so I filled in. And just one of the best experiences. I was just so surprised, because I had previously worked with a couple of other people that were just walk around with a chip on their shoulder and just not approachable. And I've worked with a couple of people that if you make direct eye contact, the next day you're getting a phone call that they need to switch you out from making eye contact with this person. So it's just unbelievable. Yeah.
Good and bad and everything, isn't it?
Or speaking, saying hi in the morning. Good morning. That type of thing. You're not supposed to speak to them. You're not supposed to make direct eye contact because they're a celebrity. So I've seen both ends of it, and I definitely like working with business people. I really do.
Yeah, totally makes sense.
Yeah.
How long did you do that for?
I did it for a few years and still doing it. If I'm fortunate enough to be in a position where I can be selective on who I like to work with, and when certain people call, I make myself available. Yeah. And then other people that I've worked with that had bad experiences, I just can't do it. I can't do it. And then typically the price will go up, $150, $160 bucks an hour. I'm sorry, I can't do it.
Yeah.
It's not worth it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not worth it. Yeah, but very interesting. Total opposite of law enforcement. The considerations for executive protection, a lot different. A little bit more detail-oriented with the executive protection, because we're talking about traveling from their home to different places that maybe you haven't been before, and just considering all the factors, things that could go wrong, where all the exits are, and all those different things that you have to take into consideration. And I've been fortunate enough to work with some good handpicked partners, Clipper, who had a lot of experience with the Sheriff's Department as well. Worked SEB for about 9-10 years, and
which is our SWAT team, and then worked intelligence as well, planning. And so he was a great partner to work with. And yeah, we had a good time.
Yeah, we'll have to get Clipper in here. In fact, we were trying to do that this morning, but we'll have to do that. Or is it BJ, right?
Yeah, BJ, yeah. The CEO of Point Blank.
Gotcha.
And we do the training.
Gotcha.
Yeah, the training.
Vision Insights is the simplest, most powerful security guard management software. No long training, no complicated systems. Guards can start reporting in minutes. Train your teams with micro trainings, attaching video to individual checkpoints to walk them through sensitive procedures. Submit accurate reports every time with dynamic observations that automatically rewrite, categorize, and prioritize, removing human error. And grow your business with daily, monthly, and quarterly insights, the most advanced reports available today. Vision Insights, the simplest, most powerful way to report.
You did some, there's a lot of different things you did. You do with security at the forum. I want to talk about that in a minute, but the shooting, you did classes on, and I was even shocked myself in the world I'm in, how often that occurs. Can you touch base a little bit on what you teach on the shooting side?
Yeah, with security officers primarily teaching the importance of safety, and even before the safety concerns, one of the most important things is situational awareness and knowing when you can and can't pull that gun out and point it at someone. Teaching them what they should be looking for, and communication skills are going to basically determine, in most cases, 90% of the time, whether you have to pull that gun out or not. If you're an effective communicator, you can get someone to comply and follow your commands and focus on you, and you make eye contact and you read their body language, and you do all these things on the front end, it can really save you a lot of heartache, because a law enforcement officer wants to pull their gun out and point it at someone. It's just not, it's a nightmare. You don't want to do that. Now, doesn't mean you're not trained to do that and you're proficient at it, but no one wakes up in the morning, goes to work, and wants to point a gun at somebody.
Yeah.
So teaching you strategies and teaching you things on the front end to help you prevent from having to do that is what the training is all about.
Yeah.
So decision-making.
And then you were also lecturing a little bit for workplace violent shootings and stuff like that. You did that for a while. That was a pretty interesting thing.
Yeah.
And I guess that's the direction I was going. I should have more talked about that. It's important what you just said, of course.
Yeah. But active shooter, yeah.
Yeah, active shooter training.
Yeah, which we have a lot of them all across the country here in California. I lost count this year, but I know, I think it was around March of this year, 2025, we had already had 200 active shooter events. And people typically think an active shooter event is when someone goes to a high profile place or a school or college or something like that and starts shooting. That is an active shooter, but there are other things that qualify for active shooters as well. And so there's no one answer or one strategy fits all for dealing with active shooters, but I was teaching different businesses and corporations how their personnel should handle being involved in an active shooter, whether it be while they're at work or even in their personal lives, if you're just out and about, because nowadays we have to consider, unfortunately, for our kids, someone going into a school, even an elementary school, with a high-powered assault rifle or handgun and shooting at kids, which should be inconceivable. But I remember as a kid, we had to do earthquake drills and get under the desk and fire drills and evacuate the building and go out to a designated spot. But now little kids have to be versed on what to do if someone comes to their campus and tries to kill them, pointing guns and shooting.
That's mind-blowing.
It's mind-blowing. It's unbelievable. And teachers as well. Teachers have to know what to do, how to lock the doors, how to barricade. So there's a couple of videos I use to illustrate some of the safest ways to do it. But it's all going to be predicated on where you are
If you're at the mall versus at the movie theater or at your school or at work, because, you know, where the exits are located and how many people are in this crowd, all those things. Even if you're in church, this is something you have to consider. On a Sunday at church or at a Bible study, these things have happened across the country. So that was part of my training, teaching people what to do, what not to do, and typically just using the FBI statistics on the active shooters that had occurred in the past and who fits the profile, which is even that. What does an active shooter look like? That's really tough to do even nowadays because they come in all shapes, sizes, and different backgrounds. And you just never know, from the disgruntled postal worker that just got fired to the ex-military guy to a female or transgender. I think we had an active shooter here in L.A. last year, 2024, or might have been 2023, and he does not fit the profile. He was a older Asian man. I think he was in his early 70s, and this happened in, I think, the Monterey Park area. Yeah, I think it was Monterey Park.
I heard about that one.
Yeah. He went to a dance school. And there was another guy that I guess was dancing too close to his girlfriend or wife, gotten too close to her, and he was aware of it. And I guess this had been brewing over some time, and he went up there and just shot, killed a couple of people at the dance school, and then hopped in a van and somehow ended up in Torrance. And they followed him. But he is not, my point in that is that he did not fit the typical active shooter profile that the FBI has, which is basically a male white between the ages of 19 and 25, a loner, doesn't have a lot of friends, not very good with the ladies, spends a lot of time online. And that's basically their profile. And it's pretty accurate. The numbers don't lie. But every now and then you have people that, you know, for whatever reason, can just decide, have a bad day, and they happen to own a firearm and decide that they're going to go out and commit this horrible crime and take some people with them. Because many times they already have if don't have a manifesto, they have a plan that they're not going to come out of this alive. And they want law enforcement to take them out. So that's part of the plan. Or sometimes before law enforcement arrives, they plan to take their own lives. It's just a hard thing to deal with because you don't know where it's coming from.
Yeah, you also mentioned to me, which kind of new, but I think people should be aware of that. You don't hear it on the news. There's a lot of them going down. How many, when you and I spoke, there was a lot each day or what?
Yeah, on average, I think around the country, there's 9 a day. Yeah, 9 a day. And that could be someone that just got fired from their job and they go back to kill the manager and then kill themselves. That's an active shooter. So yeah, it's just the access to guns nowadays, how easy it is. And as when we were on the department, I know when I came on, I was issued a revolver and some speedy loaders.
Yeah.
And we were so outgunned back then. And I think what really brought that to light was the incident that happened in LA at the Bank of America when those guys came in fully armed with assault rifles.
Yeah, that was a big deal.
And bulletproof vests. And I think at that time, our sergeants were the only one that carried AR-15 in the car, or either the sergeant had to go back to the station, to the armory, grab it and bring it out to the field. We didn't have them in the cars at that time. And LAPD didn't either. It was just, that was an eye opener for our department to see what LAPD went through.
Yeah.
And we immediately made a change.
Yeah, that was incredible.
Yeah. We switched over to the Beretta, and that at least gave us a little bit more firepower.
Yeah.
And then we start carrying rifles in the car along with the shotgun.
In fact, I think I was probably maybe the first or second class to get those.
Yeah.
I think it was 88,
yeah.
87, 88.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Really is. Did the FBI ever say like in 1970, we've had this, all of us, was it the Columbine thing that really set it off? Is it social media? What do you think? The numbers had to be drastic, way different compared to the 70s.
Yeah, yeah. The numbers have obviously gone up over the years. And I think nationwide, Columbine was most people's introduction to that, just the whole concept of that even being possible, going to a school and shooting kids. I think that was the first real, we had incidents back in the 60s and 70s, but those were political in nature and had to do with government revolt and the war and those type of things. But yeah, that was the first, Columbine was the first real thing that made people, incident that made people aware that was even the something you'd have to think about. And I'm aware of, I actually attended a debriefing at Santa Monica College. And one of the guys there, one of the sergeants there was on scene for Columbine. And he talked about the active shooter that happened at Santa Monica and what they learned from Columbine. And he was there to provide resources in terms of the after effect, aftercare for the officers as well as the staff and faculty that went through that. But yeah, that happened a few years back where this random kid in Santa Monica started the day out by killing his dad and his brother, and then he set the house on fire. And then he walks out a couple blocks, points a rifle at a female driver, makes her stop. He gets in the passenger side. She drives, and he has her stop near the college, or I think, if I'm not mistaken, right across the street from the college. He gets out, takes a couple of shots at a bus, public transportation, and then walks onto the campus. And fortunately, this happened early in the morning, so there wasn't a lot of activity on the campus in terms of students, but takes a shot at a groundskeeper, kills him. The groundskeeper had his daughter there at his job that day, killed her, and then makes his way across the campus to the library. And there were not a whole lot of people in there, but he starts shooting people in the library. And the officers, I think they were in the middle of a shift change, heard the shots and ran over to the library and engaged the suspect and killed him. But yeah, he was there debriefing that, and he talked about some of the things that they saw in Columbine. And I use that example is that a lot of the kids at Columbine, they found still sitting in their seats, holding their backpacks, just waiting to be a victim, waiting for their bullet, versus some of the kids that heard the shots and tried to get out of the window and tried to get out of there. And it speaks to your mindset. And if I push that when I'm talking about training, not only physically training, going through the motions, but also mentally training your mind, because we all know in a stressful situation, you're going to fall back on your training. Yeah. However you've trained, or if you've trained at all, that's what you're going to fall back on. And if you haven't trained your mind, you're probably going to lock up and not do anything and not move, because it takes the mind a little while to realize that this is actually, it's not a dream. It's really occurring. And if you don't already have a plan of what you are going to do, it definitely puts you more at risk. And so I tell students that one of the things I used to do with my partner when I worked patrol is when we had any downtime, we talk about just the craziest things we can think about and what we're going to do. What we're going to do if you get shot, if I get shot, or if we get ambushed. Or I knew where he kept his backup gun. I knew where he wanted to go to the hospital, where he didn't want to go to the hospital. I knew his blood type. And we, back in those days, we wrote it on our vest.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we talk about these things, and we got into a couple of hairy situations. And I'm a firm believer that anything you've thought about, and it doesn't have to be a perfect plan, but just you have a plan, you're going to do that. You're going to do those things that you've thought about or trained in your mind so that you don't just lock up and not do anything. And you want your legs to move and they won't, and you're just stuck. So I talk about that with security as well, because they're vulnerable to active shooters and coming in the mall or wherever they're placed as a guard. And it's just something that you have to consider amongst everything else. That's a consideration as well. What are you going to do? What are you responsible for? And getting people out to safety. But at the same time, if they are in shock and not willing to go, don't put yourself at risk. You just deal with the people that will listen to you, follow your instructions, and get them out safely. And all those things that go into an active shooter, which is, the list is endless. The scenarios are endless, but just being prepared mentally.
Yeah, you bring up a really good point, and I didn't think we were going to go there. I should have thought about it more, but could you, just on a real, I don't know, 1 to 5, because security people are thinking, I want to be a hero. All right, I hate to admit it, but a lot of them go, hey, I want to go get that guy.
Yeah.
What's the best thing, top 3 to 5, what they could do immediately, some of the training that you give them? Any suggestions?
Yeah, we use a video called Run, Hide, Fight. It's a pretty standard video on how to respond to an active shooter. And your first option is to run, meaning that if you hear the shots and you know the general direction they're coming from the east, then you're going to head for a west exit or anywhere out of that building. But then it's important that you have an idea where the shots are coming from, because you don't want to just hear random shots and run into the shooter. So your first option is to run. If you can get out of the building safely, do that. If you can take people with you, if they're willing to go, take them with you and get out of that building and get yourself as far away from that incident as possible. And then obviously simultaneously calling, which is one of their duties to report it, call it in. And then hide. Hiding is to say, like this building we're in right now, there's an active shooter. We hear the shots, which you're not going to mistake as fireworks when you hear rounds fired from a high power rifle. So in this situation, we would barricade that door. We slide some of these chairs, tables, barricade the door, turn the lights out, and tip this table, get in this corner here, and use this as a protective barrier. And wait for law enforcement, get on the phone, wait for law enforcement. In the history of active shooters, there's never been an active shooter that will sling his rifle over his shoulder and start trying to remove chairs and tables to get into a room. They just don't do that.
Great point.
They pull on the door, and if it's not easy access, they just go to the next door. That's your second, and then fight is your last option, because if it's a room, it's 3 of us here, the guy gets in. And the idea being we can overpower him. So you pick up something, make it into an improvised weapon, a chair, whatever it takes, and overpower him. And he can't shoot all of us. And you in that, unfortunately, in that situation, you have to pick your poison.
Yeah, should we go, Steve, get him. And then right. If he doesn't, then we go.
Right. Yeah, there's no happy outcome. And no matter where you are, this is what you do. There's no answer for that.
Yeah.
For
you
for
and Steve?
Shooter.
Okay. Okay. All right.
Yeah, but those are some of the things we just get them to think about. I talk about, and I don't know, maybe this happened during your dad's era with the Sheriff's Department. I know it was before my time. I want to say it was in the early 80s or late 70s where a commercial airliner crashed in the city of Cerritos.
I know all about it. I got to tell you that story. Go ahead.
Yeah. But from what I understand, the deputies and officers were not prepared for what they saw. They, of course, adapted and improvised, but they had never, the Sheriff's Department did not have some training that existed about how to manage a crime scene, or not a crime scene, but a scene where a commercial airline crashes in the middle of a neighborhood. We didn't know what to do. It had never happened before. Seeing people in trees, still in their seat, strapped in, seeing bodies burned and fuselage engines in the middle of houses, and just decimating a neighborhood. And I can't wait to hear, because I have a little bit of information from some old school deputies that I knew that were there That's where I got my information from. But that is a perfect example of taking advantage, whether it's in security field or law enforcement, of when you have dead time, you talk about stuff like that. What would we do if a commercial airline crashed in the neighborhood? What would we do if we had a major 10.0 earthquake and buildings start collapsing? What are we going to do? What is our job? What is our job duties shift to? And how do we stay safe and try and save as many people as we can? What's the plan? And there is no plan, but you need to make a plan. However flawed it is, it's better than having no plan.
Yeah, I think the training you mentioned, you have to go there. You have to train, because that preps the mind. Like you said, you're going to get freezed, because I think you and I, just being in law enforcement, we see some, you know, a major, really nasty homicide scene, mm-hmm. right? Our own minds, when, I don't know about you, mm-hmm. I don't want to say this about for you, but for me, I would look at it, because it's an ego thing, right? We're going to go in there. What's every cop? They want to see it, right? Mm-hmm. When you go in there, your mind, you go, that's not real. Your mind's telling you right away, that's not real. You right. really have to go, no, that is really real.
Yeah, absolutely. You know,
they really. So I can see where people would freeze, but
yeah,
the Cerritos thing, to bring it back, I knew a bunch of people that lived in that neighborhood that were gone that day. They used to work at the General Telephone Building on 183rd, was right down the street. And
wow.
they just left the house.
Wow.
On top of that, I was getting my pilot's license at the time. I was flying my cross country. I just took off from Compton Airport, and I was flying, and there was a big puff of smoke in front of me.
Wow.
I remember reaching down and having to turn my air vents, because I was flying an experimental, or it was a Citabria, they call it, and it had airflow through the side vents, and I remember having to turn those, and I flew right through it.
Wow.
It was right after it happened, and I didn't know anything about it until I got back. But I remember my dad freaking out, thinking, because it was a small plane that hit that.
That's what year was that?
Oh, that was, like I said, it was 80. Mm-hmm. It had to be 82, 83. Was it 84, 85, something like that? Somewhere around there.
Yeah. 84, yeah. 85, I graduated high school.
Yeah.
So you weren't even on the sheriff's department.
No, yet. I was not
you
on the department flying. At the time. Yeah, I was just flying.
Yeah.
But it was just tragic. And
Yeah,
it really was. It was ugly, ugly scene.
Yeah.
Yeah.
From what I understand from some of the deputies that were there, there were deputies that were just standing there staring like they saw a ghost, didn't know what to do, didn't move, just stuck.
Yeah.
Because it was just so unmanageable that something like that could happen.
Yeah, and they still had the small plane, which was another one, because it hit the T, it was a T tail on the jet, and it just decapitated the top of the airplane. That was at the schoolyard.
Wow.
Down the way, and it spun around. Pancake down.
Wow.
Yeah, it was just an ugly deal.
Yeah, yeah. But it definitely speaks to training your mind and being prepared, because I tell security guys all the time, when chaos breaks out, people are looking to you or whoever's wearing a uniform. They're looking for you to lead them. And if you freak out, they're going to freak out even more. But if you can maintain some control and have a plan and lead them out of the exits and do whatever you need to do to manage that scene and get yourself and other people to a safe place. That's what it's all about. That's going above and beyond.
Yep. And you guys, that's being a hero too. Okay. It's not taking out the shooter. I know we all dream about, man, I'd love to be the guy to go get the shooter, because you're almost angry.
Yeah.
You want to do something more, but saving other people's lives, understanding the direction, which doors to go to, how to get out of there. That's your training. That's heroic.
Yeah, it's all about risk management. And you want to mitigate risk. And you going after the shooter, you're no good to anyone. Just think about all the people you could have helped and saved had you not gone after the shooter. Going after the shooter is a risk. And the shooter is there to do one thing, and that's to kill people. And then probably his plan is to kill himself. When he starts hearing the sirens responding, he's going to kill himself. He's not even going to give law enforcement this satisfaction. So, yeah, when you're up against something like that, someone that has a death wish and is willing to do whatever it takes, you got to think ahead of them, save yourself, save as many people as you can, and get out of there in one piece.
Yep. And so, you're a valuable resource to law enforcement. Tell me if I'm wrong.
Absolutely.
If you can pinpoint direction and show or explain or tell where you think that shooter is, because that's very valuable for law enforcement.
Absolutely.
People coming to the scene, especially if you can pinpoint.
Yes, absolutely. Description and all that. Very valuable information.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a big part of BCIS right now, as far as the Bureau of Security.
Yeah, they incorporated it into their training, because back in 2020, when I started training for BSIS, I wasn't teaching I was doing active shooter on my own. There was no material, but now it's part of their curriculum, and they actually dedicate a pretty good portion of information towards active shooters and what the expectations are. So yeah, definitely BSIS is, they have to. It's happening all across the country every single day. Yeah, they definitely are. They have taken steps to make sure that officers have somewhat idea of what's expected. And they do talk specifically about not trying to be a hero and doing what you need to do to survive. Yeah.
It's getting worse, right? Not better.
It's getting worse in a different kind of way, though. I remember in the 80s with all the drive-bys, it's a lot of violent crime going on. And then when PCP was prevalent, I remember a lot of stabbings and stuff like that. Somebody, it was more violent crime. Now it's a little bit more, I guess you could say, sophisticated with the crimes now. A lot of fraud, a lot of beating people out of their money. Still violent crime, but it's just different. I remember, just like you were talking about, seeing some of these homicide scenes. It was just violent. It was so violent back in the 80s with crack cocaine and people, the gangs and their territories and the weapons they had back then. I remember a guy, and I wasn't even on the department. I was in high school, and this was in Linwood. I remember a guy, I was with my friend, and we were standing in front of his house. This guy came out of his driveway, out of his garage, down the driveway, and stood in the middle of the street and fired an AK-47 down the street. And every round vibrated your body. You could feel it, like you're in a war-torn region. And I just couldn't believe it. It was so unreal. And then the body does what it does to protect itself. So my hearing was muffled. It was so loud, but then I couldn't hear anything. And then I saw him moving in slow motion. And then all of a sudden it was real time, real speed. But I will never forget that type of weapon. And that was in the 80s.
Yeah, remember, that was a big deal. Like, AKs, or how didn't these AKs? Now it's like a dime a dozen, right?
Oh,
they build them.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And those AKs, those rounds.
They go through everything.
Go through multiple cars. He had no idea where those rounds were going. Through people's houses and just in the middle of the day.
Yeah.
And then the sheriff's department responded to that house, and they end up, he ended up barricading himself in the house, and they ended up going in after him. The SWAT team got there, SEB, and they took him out. But, yeah, I was a sophomore in high school. Yeah. Unbelievable. So the crimes were violent back then. And I think there's still violence today, but a lot more, you know, I don't know, maybe just the political climate, along with everything else, and how people are so divided, not only racially, but politically. Our society is just in a bad place right now. I remember how people came together during 9/11, not just people in New York, but people all across the country. We all bonded together, and we looked at each other. You looked at your fellow man as an American, and we all had the same perspective on that. They came over here and did that to us. And I just don't think we think that way today. It's just,
we forget.
Yeah. How quickly we forget.
Yep.
Yeah. Different climate today, but still, yeah, it's definitely getting worse.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's deep, huh?
Yeah.
It's absolutely.
I don't know how we got on that subject.
No, it's good because I talked to you and I asked you, especially with Vision Insights, I asked you because you've got a great background to come in. We want to do some training. Mm-hmm. Obviously, this isn't just about the podcast, but the training, your background to start incorporating some of this or more of this and having you on the podcast more to share. Because of your background. It's very interesting. It's very important.
Yeah.
Because we want these guys to have all the information they can to make really good decisions.
Absolutely.
And where are they going to go for it anymore? And training is painful for a lot of them. So we're trying to make it more storytelling so it's interesting so they learn.
Yeah.
And it impacts them maybe in a different way. Yeah. You are doing training right now. You're doing BCIS. You are teaching security personnel. Mm-hmm. If you want to give that, you're doing baton. You're doing quite a few things with that as well, right?
Yeah. I'm doing just a 40-hour guard card basic course and then a taser. I'm a taser instructor and then baton and OC spray and then firearm as well. Yeah. I think there's something to be said for learning from someone that I'm not teaching things that I learned in a book. I actually have cleared a house. I actually have taken people into custody. I've used my taser over the years many times, used my baton. There was a period of my career where I was working in Linwood Station a year before it merged with Firestone Station and became Century Station. And there was a very busy time in the early 90s. And I only say that because you can work certain places in the county or the city where you never have to pull your gun out. You never have to use your baton, swing it. And that's not to say anything about positive or negative about those officers, but it's just the areas you work. And I worked in a very violent area at that time. And getting guns pointed at you and pointing guns at people,
it was
pulling
routine,
over cars.
Right?
Yeah.
And you bring up an interesting point. So it was Carson, Firestone, Linwood. They called it the Bermuda Triangle. So I worked Carson, you were at Linwood, right? And then they brought it into Century, right? Carson's still out there, but they brought it Century. Mm. But yeah, called the Stone for a reason in Linwood, right?
Yeah. And then right there, you got South LA, which is South LA now, but it was known as Lenox Station.
Wow. Yes.
Very busy.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I worked in that area. And yeah, so it's funny, I tell these stories in the class, incidents that I've seen over the many years, 33 years with the Sheriff's Department. And sometimes I have to remind myself that these things like actually happened. Like I tell these stories and I'm listening to myself like, wow, that really happened. I really saw that. I really heard that bullet whiz by. I was working with a partner, actually my training officer, on New Year's. And someone took some shots at us. I think we were in Willowbrook. And I remember arrow responding, flying over. We thought it came from this house. And we were pinned down behind our car. And yeah, it really happened. Working New Year's was not a good night to be working.
I remember with Terry Winger, we were at the Yoshi Bowl trying to eat some outside the radio car, right? And it was like, you hear this, was that a mosquito? What was that? And Terry goes, no, we're taking around. We're down underneath the radio car. It's crazy.
Yeah.
And you think, when you're young, you're thinking, that could have killed us.
Yeah.
And you just, it was part of, it's crazy.
Yeah. I remember driving down Atlantic, me and my partner. Car goes flying by us, lights are out, and it's 7 o'clock, so it's dark. So we whip a U-turn, and as soon as we get behind this car, it takes off and ends up in Linwood and went around this corner, kind of streets are narrow in Linwood, so went around this corner, couldn't negotiate that turn and hit this big tree. Passenger and driver's side doors pop open. And driver goes one way. Now, we're not supposed to split.
Yep.
But I go after the driver. My partner goes after the passenger. And I'm running, chasing this guy. And he's maybe 6 feet in front of me. I'm running right behind him. I'm young. I'm like 22. And he goes through the driveway, crosses the street,
down another driveway, and as he reaches that fence to jump over it, I catch up to him. I grab him, pull him down. He says, he literally says, "I'm not going back to jail." So now we're getting it on. We're fighting in the driveway there. And I happen to have a little bit of size on him. So I was able to get on top of him, get in control of him, get him handcuffed. By that time, arrows got there. They're flying, looking for me. And I'm on my radio and got the guy handcuffed and go to stand him up and search him. And he's got a 45 in his waist. Now, I didn't think about it until afterwards. At any time I was chasing him, he could have just turned on me, pulled that gun out, turned on me, and shot me. But I'm 22, and I'm not – you can't be out there afraid doing the job. But you think about some of the things afterwards, and you go, wow, I could have bought it tonight.
Levant, I'll share one because I know we're running a camera. But 211 suspect burger joint. And you know what they always say when you – take a body from another officer, search him before you put him in the car. So I asked the officer, was there? He go, is he clear? He goes, yeah, we patted him down. He's good. Mm. Big Samoan guy. Okay, they had him in flex cuffs, couldn't put the arms in behind him. Get him to the station, and I happened to know him, had a relationship with him through the custody gang. His name is Feagi Tumalatai. I'll never forget it. Pull him out of the radio car. Same thing, 45, sitting on the floorboard, loaded.
Wow.
Wow. And three striker, easy.
Yeah.
And luckily, I had a relationship with him.
Yeah.
But it's stuff like that.
Yeah.
You're right.
And we didn't have the, we had the cushions in the,
that's
the
right,
time.
The seats. Had to, yeah, we had to take the, yeah. You'd find they weren't hard molded.
Yeah.
Right?
At the end of the night, you'd find all kind of stuff in those cushions, right?
Yeah.
Crack cocaine, everything. And these guys, some of these people were double jointed. So you handcuff them behind their back.
Yep.
Get them to the station to go book them, and their hands are in front of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how did you do that?
Yeah, I'll tell you. I didn't pin the gun on him.
Yeah.
I didn't. Yeah. I thanked him.
Yeah.
I said, it's not your gun, is it? Whether it was you there or not, I don't know. It wasn't in the report, so me and the foreign sergeant found property. A lot of guys looked at me different, and I go, no.
Yeah.
Out of respect.
Absolutely.
Out of respect.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Because I got a twin brother out there. And
right.
And he would believe it or not, he's been approached a few times too.
I can believe it.
Yeah. Again, you've done forum security. You've done, you do BSI training, BSIS training as well. And you and I are going to definitely have a conversation because I want to have you back more to help us with that. And I think people like to hear the stories.
You're
in the mix of all of it. And we're going to put a lot of these hopefully together for really good materials for folks.
Okay.
To take a look at too.
Looking forward to that. Yeah, the MBA thing is new. I applied and ended up getting, this is during COVID, and ended up making it through the, I had four interviews and ended up making it through the selection process. And all those guys that work for the MBA, they call them security reps. They don't deal with, they're not arena security, so they don't deal with the drunks and all the things that happen at this arena. They basically are player and official referee protection. And then part of the duties is doing an audit on the actual arena to make sure that everything in the contract that the NBA has with them is in place. And so typically when I work crypto, they have 13 to 14 LAPD officers armed inside. I'm unarmed. Don't have to be because those guys are, they strategically place them where they need to be.
Okay.
Inside. And so my job is focused on the referees because people hate the referees.
Really?
So, oh, yeah. So getting the referees on the court safely, off the court, and then players, any player ejections and stuff like that. You're walking them back to the locker room. So you get to know the players. And certainly I know all the referees for the NBA and WNBA. You get to know those folks. So interesting, definitely different from typical my law enforcement duties, but I'm having a ball because I'm a big basketball fan. So to sit there on the floor and watch, be able to watch the game a little bit.
Yeah, well, you're not tiny. What are you, 6'4"?
6'3"?
6'4". Yeah, lucky. Yeah. I'm 6'1". I'd love to be 6'4". And you look great, too, by the way.
Thank you.
And you don't look your age. 22, right? Oh, no, we're not 22 anymore, are we? Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
I'll tell you one thing, Levant. It's been an honor, man. Not only to have you as a friend for all the years, start the department with you where we met, and we kept that relationship. And it just, I don't know. Everybody said time goes by quick, but when you're 27, 28 at the time, you're going, oh, man, I got 20 years of this department. Now look at us, man.
Yeah. And I remember the older guys that we considered were older, and they were like in their 40s, telling you, trying to help you to prepare, you know, telling you, make sure you max out your deferred comp and put some money away and giving you all those little nuggets, you know. And you're like, get out of here, old guy.
Yeah, no kidding. No. Realize what that guy's done, what they've gone through.
And
got pulled over by Seal Beach Police Department. I was on my cell phone. Two of them were in the car. They pulled me over.
Yeah.
And they ran my license. I still come back with the confidentiality thing. And the guy goes, man, you work for LA County Sheriff's Department?
Yeah.
Sir.
Yeah.
Oh, tell me what it was like. Can you? Man, they kept me there 15 minutes. They thought I was the bomb back in the day, because things, so much has changed.
Oh,
you know, the things that they've done. And we were blessed in a certain way, but we were lucky.
Yes, very.
We were very lucky.
Very.
The world has changed. It was really was a lot of fun playing Batman and Robin, right? I hate to use that term, but sure felt like it, huh? Especially after you tackle that guy in the shooting. I know, to hold this, but come on. You wrestle that guy to the ground, and you're walking that guy back.
Yeah.
Sometimes you get to remember there's not too many telephone booths change out, you know, like Superman.
Absolutely.
It's adrenaline factor. It's a high. Then how do you go home to your wife? Hey, what's your day today, honey?
I tried to keep those two things separate, my personal home life. Yeah. It just worked out better for me that way.
Yeah.
So I didn't. And my wife, if I would told her half the things I seen out there and was involved in, she would have been even more worried than she was. That's the kind of thing you talk about with your other colleagues. And I didn't have too many. All my friends weren't cops. I got a lot of friends that didn't have the same profession as me. Some guys I met when I was in the military, still friends with. And so that's good to have somebody to talk to and share those things, because I just think about how we had to see the things we saw, remain professional, and show up, be there the next day for work, and you're working crazy hours, and you're being forced to work overtime, and it's a very demanding job, and I always took pride in that. It was a privilege to work that job. It wasn't a right, and I didn't feel like anybody should be able to work that job. You had to be a special individual to do that.
Yeah, when you're getting off at 2 o'clock in the morning, working that PM shift, and having to go to court 8 in the morning, 3 or 4 hours, a bunch of reports down, all that. It's
a thankless job.
It is.
Yeah.
I think my first wife was on the department. I don't recommend that, because it's not really attractive when you and your wife are talking shop all the time, right? Or you get in an argument, she goes, do you want to kick his ass? Do you want me to kick his ass?
She's your senior.
Senior, exactly. My buddies would call me, hey, tell your wife to calm down. She's supervising us too hard. Yeah, it's not very fun, but you know how that worked out.
Yeah.
Anyways, but hey, I appreciate you. Love you, man. Always have.
And, love you too, man.
I can't wait to, we'll get you back here again too.
Absolutely.
All right, and talk more.
Next time we'll have a script and we'll actually talk about what we're supposed to talk
about. Yeah, you know what? That's the fun part about this, right?
Yeah.
And I hate to do that, because we get in it, especially me, with my ADHD and everything else bouncing around. I never stay to the script.
Yeah.
And it just makes it more natural, because you feel like you got to think about it.
Yeah, so. It's fine. I think you're right. I think a lot of people enjoy hearing your perspective from security and law enforcement, executive protection, all the different things, because they're all different in their own way. And so there are people out there that are going to listen to this podcast that are doing those things. And hopefully we've said something that can help them.
Yeah.
In doing their job more professional. And
30 years, my friend.
Yeah.
30 years in this stuff.
I
was complimenting some guy's car the other day. He went to the gym and said, hey, how do you like your audience? Just loving it. So that's a really cool car. That looks really nice. He goes, thank you, sir.
Yeah.
I'm like, right. Why is he calling me, sir? Oh, because I'm old.
Yeah.
It's funny.
Interesting thing about those Seal Beach guys that came up to you, pulled you over. Their chief is a former L.A. County sheriff.
That's right, huh?
Yeah, he worked Carson Station.
No kidding.
For
That's my home ground.
Yeah, I think he...
Give him a shout out. What's his name?
Oh, man, don't put me in the spot.
Okay.
But I think he left after, 7 or 8 years.
Wow.
He worked Carson Station. He worked custody.
Okay.
Went to Carson, and then he left Carson for Seal Beach. There was an incident that happened, and he made the switch. He lateraled over for the betterment of his family.
Yeah.
And this guy worked his way all the way from a patrol officer to now the chief.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah.
We got to get him in here, maybe.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that'd be a good interview.
That would, huh?
Yeah.
That'd be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you for coming. I'm going to have you back.
Okay. Absolutely.
Right. And be safe, too. All right.
All right. You too, man.
All right, bud.
Thank you.
Comment, like, share, and subscribe.